You're listening to DraftKings Network.
This Friday, Boy Kills World. The must-see action movie event of the year hits theaters.
Yes! The Vanderkoys killed my family. Now, I'm gonna kill them one by one.
Critics are calling it Looney Tunes on acid.
You know how hard it is to get a cereal company to sponsor mass murder?
Weapons. Danger. Let's do this.
Bill Skarsgård in Boy Kills World. In theaters Friday. Rated R.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Welcome to the Big Suey, a podcast exclusive.
Risky move.
Just when you thought the show could not be more diluted.
Walk the plank.
Bam!
No more free Disney trips.
Now here's the marching band of nowhere.
Matey.
Fat face.
Dan's been stress eating.
And the habitual liar.
Stugatz can't be trusted.
The Big Suey.
Yo ho, a pirate radio life for me.
We've liked this guy for a long time down here. Always was somebody that Miami Heat fans and the organization speak so highly of him because he was a maximum professional. He sort of was the embodiment of working hard. The way that Mike Ryan annoys you talking about Heat culture, that's a thing that Brian Grant embraced in his bones. He's got a new book, Rebound, Soaring in the NBA, Battling Parkinson's, and Finding What Really Matters. It is available now, and Brian is with us. And Brian, it's good talking to you. The book, how was that process for you? Thank you for making time for us. How was the process of sitting down and going through your entire past and sort of living your life again, right? When you write something like this, you have to go through all of it. What was that process like for you?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, first and foremost. It was an emotional journey. It's something I've always wanted to do. I wasn't ready, because if I'm gonna write a book, I don't want a half step. I didn't want to tell half the story. I wanted to tell all the story. So that's probably what kept me from doing it for so long. But it was a freeing process, because as you read through the story, there's a lot of me trying to forgive myself for a lot of things that I did to other people and to myself. So, it was emotional, but I'm glad I did it.
What was most freeing?
I would say the fact that I had a wonderful wife who made things work after all the craziness I put her through with the depression when I retired. And I kind of felt like the image she got was that she left me because I had Parkinson's, which is not true at all. You know, I ruined that relationship over 12 years in the NBA and 9 months of heavy depression. And so that's one of the biggest things. And I want that for her, because she's a good woman.
I talked to Shane Battier about this the other day. Uniquely qualified, you would think, right, to be able to handle whatever it is that comes with retirement. But, Brian, so many guys like you, it's so hard to lose your identity. I can't even imagine what that was, and I can't imagine how freeing it must be now to be able to put it all out there for everybody to see, a life examined.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely freeing. Thing about professional athletes, people try to tell us things when we're younger, and we just look at the older guys like, yeah, right, whatever. And I can remember being in Phoenix with Vinny Del Negro, and he sat me down and says, you're thinking about retiring? I said, yeah, my knee is gone. And he said, Brian, I just want to tell you, there's not enough fishing, golf, tennis in the world to fill your time. You're probably going to go through some depression. And so I thought that was the reason why I was going through depression. I think that kicked it off, but the fact that I had maybe 20% of my dopamine producing cells left in my brain is really what I found out later through my neurologist happens to a lot of people who are diagnosed with Parkinson's.
Not a delicate question, but since you brought us down this path, what happened with your wife? What do you want people to know?
Just that she's a wonderful woman with all the situations I put her through. Being in the league is tough in itself, but then when you add extra pressure to your marriage and to your family life, that can destroy anything over time. And that's kind of what happened. And it's not me here cheerleading for us. It's me saying that I really appreciate and respect her, because there was a time where I had an opportunity to really support her and what she was doing with Zumba, but I didn't. And I know how I would have felt if she hadn't supported me all those years.
And so what happened to her? What do you know happened to her in terms of perception when you say, well, she's gotten hit with this stigma of she left me when I had Parkinson's?
Well, I don't think she was directly hit. It was more so me having conversations with people, and I could tell that they either wanted to ask or they were insinuating that she was gone because I had Parkinson's. And that's just not true at all. You know, she went through a lot. She put up with a lot. And if it wasn't for her, I don't think I would have the relationship with all my children that I have, because she never let me just say, forget it. And there were a lot of times I wanted to do that because of the problems I was having with their moms.
It's pretty hard for the NBA athlete to resist all of the temptations that come with money and glory, correct?
It can be. If you don't have a good solid base or foundation, and I thought I did, but didn't happen that way.
So what was the solid base and foundation that you think that you had? Like, you grew up a small rural community, Georgetown, Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about the racism, you know, in Georgetown when I was growing up, and it was there. I'm not, you know, giving anybody a pass on that. But it was also a great place to grow up, because I had so many cousins and aunts. And I mean, my dad's entire family lived there. So I had 12 cousins that we were at the courts, climbing trees, throwing rocks, whatever we could think of doing for fun. And, you know, I touched on the other end of it, because there are actually people who think that, man, there wasn't any racism back here. And I'm saying, but you're not black. You're with me 3 hours out of the day, the other 21 you don't see. And so it was a great place to grow up, because I was sheltered. You know, I'd go and visit family down in Cincinnati, and you don't know how poor you are in the country, because everybody's poor. And you think, for me, I thought if you had brick on your house, you were rich. You know, that was how I gauged it until I started going to college in Cincinnati.
And what was that like for you to transition from what your upbringing was to all of a sudden, whatever the culture shock is, with not that?
I grew up, I mean, I talk about that base. The base was being in a place there where I was sheltered, but I still was exposed to things. I mean, I have a crazy family. I love them to death, but we're crazy at times. And to go to Cincinnati, play 4 years of college ball, and then to get drafted into Sacramento just blew my mind. Because when I was growing up, there were only black and white people. I had never met, you know, a Mexican. I had never met an Asian. It was a culture shock, but it was one that I needed and one that I wanted to see. My cousin and I, when we moved to Sacramento, it was great.
When you say you had a crazy family, what does that mean?
I mean, you're in a little town where biker gangs come through. I can remember when we were kids, and it would be like somebody come in, yeah, such and such got hit with a bottle. And all the uncles and aunts uptown, and then the next day it's like, all right, we got to get such and such out of jail. We need to raise bail for this one and that one. And that's basically what I mean by crazy. I mean, it was – to me, it was crazy.
When you say that it was emotional writing the book, is the most emotional thing you had to write about different than the most freeing thing?
Not really. I mean, I think when, you know, you touch, when I went back and really examined myself in my marriage of 15 years, that's a long time. It's a lot of, you know, years of my, you know, taken out of my life. And I think they were kind of right next to it, wanting to make sure that I did her justice. And at the same time, being able to forgive myself for what I did, you know, I made a lot of mistakes. And the book has just given me an opportunity to say, okay, here, this is what you know, this is what I know, but here's the other side of things.
So the finding what really matters in the title of the book, what is the finding what really matters?
My kids, you know, me being there for them, and the relationships, the close personal relationships that I've had with people that have helped me with my relationship with my kids. That's really what matters. I mean, I have Parkinson's. My older kids grew up watching me progress and they're okay with it. My two littles, you know, they're just now really getting to understand what it is. I mean, there's a lot of situations I wouldn't have made it through without my kids.
What has Parkinson's taught you?
It taught me that I'm not invincible. If that, you know, if you can believe that. I mean, when we were playing ball, it was easy to go out there and go down the middle. No, you're going to get cracked in the head, dunk on somebody. Somebody's going to dunk on you. You're going to twist an ankle, whatever. But you were always able to rehab that ankle or knee, have a surgery, take anti-inflammatories. But with Parkinson's, that's, you can battle it as much as you want, but it's still going to progress. You may be able to slow it down with exercise and nutrition, but eventually it's going to win. And it's, that's probably been one of the hardest things for me, and I'm sure other Parkinson's patients to wrap their head around, because for a long time, things were really good with me. I'd meet people when I had, you know, I had 8 to 10 years, and they were just diagnosed within 2 years. And, you know, I kind of was still doing all right, but I'm starting to hit that plateau and the descent into more symptoms.
What are the details you remember from the initial news?
About Parkinson's or about?
Yes.
Oh. The first person that told me that I had Parkinson's, Dan, was in Miami. His name was Philippe Manicombe. And I know he's worked on people like Timberland, Shaquille O'Neal. I just so happened to get lucky meeting him at the fish market where the boats come in over in Coconut Grove. And, you know, we became fast friends, and I realized that he was really good at what he did in Chinese medicine. And we were coming back from Portland to Miami. I was checking on my house, and I'm giving him all these things I think it is. And he just kind of stopped me and said, you know, tested my hand and said, brother, you have Parkinson's. I'm just going to tell you what nobody else will tell you, but there's things we can do, you know, to help you have a nice normal life. You don't have to suffer if you put in the work, that kind of thing. So it was, I was kind of pissed off, to tell the truth, because I was like, hold on, how are you? And then I went to, you're not even a real doctor, that type of stuff. But he was absolutely right.
So what sort of stuff? What, when he says there are things you can do, what are those things?
When I first was diagnosed by a neurologist, they gave me this drug called Azelect, which is supposed to be a neuroprotector. I took it for 30 days and thought, well, I'm not going to take this for 30 days and then go see them in 6 months. You know, I want to try to be more proactive about it. So I took the natural approach. And for a long time, it worked. I would get IVs of glutathione, vitamin C, vitamin A. I was taking all these different supplements that all break down in your body and produce dopamine. But after a while, you know, when I first started it, my monthly bills were about $1,200. And then fast forward to 6 months later, now my monthly bills are $4,000 a month. And I'm like, this can't be right. I know everybody can't afford to pay $4,000 a month. And then it hit me that, you know, I'd look at my blood work and my iron may be down just 0.01. And all of a sudden you need to buy our iron to bring your iron up. And it started to become a hustle, you know? And so I broke away and went to conventional medicine. And that's what led me here.
So you felt like you were being ripped off. For those who don't know, by the way, the Brian Grant Foundation, it partners with other foundations, the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, Muhammad Ali's Parkinson's Center, to support and fund research dedicated to finding a cure for Parkinson's disease and to finding improved therapies for people with Parkinson's disease. But when you say that the symptoms have advanced, Brian, and that you're in, because you've been dealing with this for a long time, and I don't know what that journey has been like for you. I can't imagine what that journey has been like for you.
Yeah, it's one of the things Michael J. Fox told me was that I'm going to have to let go of the ego. And I didn't really know what he meant at the time, but, you know, being an athlete, first of all, I didn't believe in depression until it hit me for 9 months. And I've always been used to being presentable, if I'm saying that right, being presentable, in shape, things like that. And now I'm dealing with something where, you know, I can't stop this. I can take meds, but it slows things down a little bit. But I've had to get out of myself because I am kind of one of those people who worry about what people think. And I start thinking to myself, what would I do if I saw a big 6'9" black man coming down the street doing this thing? And that's kind of held me back a little bit. I've gotten a lot better, but it's something that anyone who has any type of disorder or disease where it's physically visible, I think they go through.
Brian, were you ashamed at the beginning? Because I could see you arriving at a point where you're this big, tough warrior playing basketball, and maybe you're ashamed of what's going on with your physical appearance.
I was ashamed. I can remember when I moved back to Portland and I was being honored at halftime with Chris Dudley and Jerome Kirsty, the late Jerome Kirsty. And we were in a tunnel, and I hadn't told anybody that I had Parkinson's yet. And so I'm sitting there and my arm is tremoring, and I finally just turned to Jerome and said, "Hey man, I've got Parkinson's." He said, "What?" I go, "Yeah, I have Parkinson's. I don't want to go out there because I don't want people to see it." And he said, "Don't worry about it, I got you." And we walked out, we waved, threw some t-shirts at people, came back in, and he goes, "I couldn't even tell." And I know if I couldn't tell, I was right next to you, that the crowd couldn't tell. And I watched the video and you really couldn't tell, but it's just that whole mindset that, you know, people are focusing on you, they're seeing it, and they're going to judge you for it. And this is something that is out of my control. You know, I can't control whether you guys come and interview me or don't. It's really up to you.
You wore a good disguise, though, Brian, because I wouldn't have covering you, I wouldn't have guessed that you were someone who cared a whole lot what others thought.
You know what? We all know how to front. You know, we all know how to act like, yeah, I don't really care what you think, but deep down, in a lot of instances, I do.
How did you get a control of your ego? When Michael J. Fox says you got to let go of the ego, where did you learn along the path, okay, this is going to humble me?
As I started going to events and kind of putting myself out there, you know, Rick Bucher, I called him when he was with ESPN, and he's the one that came up and kind of broke the story. And as I started getting out in the public more, I realized that most people I was going to my son's football games with had somebody very close to them that had Parkinson's. And people coming up, my dad has it, my mom has it, my brother, my sister, my cousin, my best friend. And I realized there's a lot of people that were suffering from Parkinson's. And the more I put myself out there and met other people with PD, the more the ego was stripped away. I'm not saying it's completely gone, but definitely not like it was when I first came into
having gone. having gone through the process of writing the book, you look back now and say what to the 24-year-old or 26-year-old or 30-year-old Brian Grant? What are the things that you would want him to know?
First of all, we never knew we were going to be in this position. Coming up in Georgetown, going to Xavier, senior year, I'm looking for a job and end up going with Mark Bartlestein, and we go to the Desert Classic. I go from a second rounder to an eighth pick. And I would just say that it's going to be a great journey, but you're going to need to lean on people who are morally trying to help you in a good way. Not that I seek people that do things in a bad way, but know that the decisions that I make over those next 12 years in the NBA are going to affect me for life.
So do you feel like you were sort of corrupted along the path there, Brian? Because it sounds like you're looking back on that guy, and the writing of a book does some of this. It conjures up whatever it is, introspection, looking in the hard places, shame. And if it's going to be an honest look, that stuff becomes really hard to write about. So visiting that place, what was that like?
It was emotional. It was emotional. There were some positives to it, too, because after finishing the book and kind of reading through, it's like, man, it's almost unbelievable. If I hadn't been the one to go through it, I don't know if I would have believed somebody about it. You know, it's just my junior year, everybody in my town thought I was nothing. You know, my mother thought I was nothing, but I put me through the windshield of her car, slamming on her brakes. And after a summer of getting beat up on the courts and playing, coming back, barely making it to play my senior year, then this thing just starts going. And I had nothing to lose. So any opportunity that came my way, I was going to jump on it. And so just with that, I mean, that was a good thing to look back on, and that makes me happy. But all the hard things that I had to look upon were tough to get through.
When you say 9 months of depression, you said that a couple of times, the specifics of the months. How did you get out of it?
First of all, I went 6 months telling Gina and whoever else came to the house that I wasn't depressed, but I wasn't leaving the house. And after about 6 months, I knew I had a problem because I get up, get a big bowl of Captain Crunch, sit down in front of the TV and turn it on the Hunting Channel. That was my routine, and I thought that was normal. And then finally, I went in to get help, and I was diagnosed with clinical depression. I was put on meds, and then after 3 months of doing that, my head started clearing up.
Was it the lack of regimen? What was happening? The loss of identity? What was it?
It was a mixture of all that. You know, I can remember I went to the first Heat game. I was sitting behind the backboard. People were coming up, you know, saying thank you, good career, things like that. But at halftime, I had so much anxiety because my mind and my eyes were telling me I was supposed to be over there on the bench. And I'm up here in the stands now. And it was just, you know, I'm sweating. And I just told my kids, we got to go. And that was the last game I went to during that season. And so it was a mixture of retirement, seeing people moving on without me, you know, being home now all the time, depression. It was just a big, you know, mixture of things.
Rebound, soaring in the NBA, battling Parkinson's and finding what really matters. We didn't even talk, Brian. We didn't even talk about the fact that when you were young, you were sequestered in a tent for how long was it? How long were you sequestered in a tent? Because I'm imagining as you re-go through the details of your story, you're like, wow, how did all of this happen?
Well, I can remember that morning. My mom took me to my grandma's, and that's where all the kids would go. And we'd walk to school because it was just down the hill from her house. And I was sick. She knew I was sick. And my grandma always had this stove, oil burning stove, and she kept it, I mean, like 100 and something in the house. And so she comes and lays me on the couch, hits the door, and I just start crying because I couldn't breathe. I couldn't catch my breath. And she heard that and turned around and came back in. Now, if she hadn't done that, I could have maybe died because everybody was asleep. And so she took me to hospital when I was diagnosed with double pneumonia. And I think I was in tent for 2 weeks in oxygen tent. And actually on the third day, I locked myself in the bathroom because I got tired of them coming, giving me those big penicillin shots in my butt. And it was hurting. And so I locked myself in there thinking they couldn't get in there. And they changed my medication from the shots to the pills. But that was a scary time. But I was a kid. I think I was only in, second grade or something like that.
Howdy, folks. It's Mike Ryan. I'm living the gimmick right now. The playoffs have already gotten me, and we're a couple of days into it. It's like a playoff equinox that's going on right now. It's ridiculous. And if you're like me, you like rooting on your team. Trust me, I just bought 3 for my wife, daughter, and myself for game 1. I live it. Because I've been out there. I've been out in those streets. I've been panicking last second trying to find deals. And then when I eventually settle on something, I'm not sure if it's the lowest price out there, and I'm getting just totally blitzed with surprise fees. Well, thankfully, Game Time takes it out of the equation. All the fees are up front. There's no surprises. You get to see what your seat looks like. It's amazing, the technology we have these days. But Game Time has your back always. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app right now, create an account, and use code DAN for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code DAN for $20 off. Download the Game Time app today. Last minute deals, lowest price, guaranteed.
Well, Stugatz wants to get in here with some light stuff. We didn't even point out to go from across the entire journey to making more money in your career than Michael Jordan. Did you know that you made more, you earned more in your career, Brian, than Michael Jordan did in his entire Wizards and Bulls playing career?
Did not know that.
You didn't know that.
That would be the thing. Like for me, that'd be the thing. I'm proud. You've done a lot of great work, but on the court, that would be the thing that would lead my resume. I would be proudest of that.
Michael Jordan made $93 million from the Bulls and Wizards, but yes, Stugatz is money hungry. You made a lot more than he did.
Made more than MJ.
Yeah, I know. That's pretty good. That's pretty good, Brian.
Because I can say something.
You don't want to say it? What happened? Did we go?
No, just didn't know that.
All right. Tell me how you feel about this. Do you agree with us that Bam Adebayo would destroy and embarrass Larry Bird?
I'm not even going now.
What?
I got to tell you, listen, I haven't been watching a whole lot of basketball, but I have been watching a lot of YouTube, and Larry Bird was no punk, dude. I mean,
Larry Legend.
So Larry used to get beat up. I was like, no. He brought it to whoever. And it changed my perception of Larry Bird. Larry Bird was not only a great player, but he was somebody who wasn't going to take any crap. And I respect the hell out of that.
Brian, thank you for being on with us again. Rebound, soaring in the NBA, battling Parkinson's, and finding what really matters. I mean, what do you have for Brian Grant before he gets out of here?
Well, from a basketball perspective, Brian was like the first undersized guy that they would put on single coverage on Shaq. And so I wanted to hear your best.
Oh, it was so wrong.
Guarding Shaq's
story. It was so wrong. Tim Duncan says that you're one of the hardest, or maybe, I think Tim Duncan said you're the hardest working player in the league. But that, I remember thinking, Brian, you were a giant man, but you looked like you were hanging from one of Shaq's earlobes.
Are we talking about when I was in Miami or prior to that? Because when I got to Miami, things changed. I went from 267. Fast and quick to 245, 247. I gave up 20 pounds. I was lean. I was fit. But you give up that kind of weight against somebody like that, it's a lot of times you're going to get moved out the way. And, you know, I've been doing so many interviews, and it always, the Shaq thing comes up. So I'm thinking I might get a phone call here at some point, like, well, hold on, man. How did you think you was holding me? You know, something like that. But it was a thing that I had to think about. Like, anytime I knew I had to guard him, I just had to conjure up whatever I could to just get mad at him. And so by the time we got to the jump, I was so crazy mad, like, oh, you called my mama. You know, And that was the only way I would survive the first couple trips up and down the court. And then after, once he got a little tired from chasing me, then that's when I could try to work on his ribs. When you could work on ribs, you can't do ribs no more.
Is that the most unpleasant of the assignments? There wasn't one more unpleasant than that, was there?
Karl Malone.
Oh, man.
Two different beasts. Like, Shaq was big and strong and move you out the way dunking. Karl is big and strong, will hit jumpers on you, will post you up. And more importantly, I always consider myself probably one of the fastest power forwards in the league as far as running the floor. But he's fast. And when that ball goes up and comes off, if I'm looking and I'm not putting my head down going, it's a layup because, he's that quick.
Save him from, like, a group of angry fans in Alaska or something?
Yeah, it was we were on a fishing trip. We raised $107,000 for that one fishing trip, by the way. So the mailman did deliver. Let me put that out there. We're there at this resort. And he stops by and says he's heading on up to the – it's like a bar, car playing area. And I get up there and I come through the door, and he's back against the bar, and there's like four dudes around him. I see him doing this. And he goes, there he is. Brian, would you tell them that we are friends now? And I go, hey, what's going on? And the guy goes, Gus, Oregon City. Ted, Milwaukee. And I go, Brian Westland, Carl's okay. And I told him what he did, and they were like, really? Pat him on the back. You guys have a good time. Walked off. Funny. I mean,
saved his life.
Nah, I mean, he was joking when he said saved his life, because, yeah.
Brian, thank you for being on with us. We appreciate it.
Hey, guys, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.